Hi.
Hi.
How are you doing today? Oh, you have a spooky story to tell me.
I do have a story to tell you because you always ask me what's going on and I'm like, nothing, because I stay in my house every single day and I still don't have a job. but something interesting actually has happened
for nice.
Once. So for the past couple of months, I've noticed the same number like recur everywhere. And people say that like, oh, once you notice it one time and you attach significance to it, then anytime you see it, you're going to attach significance to it. But I mean, like I will get in my car, the radio will turn to that time. I will get up from watching TV, go to make dinner. The microwave will turn to that time. I will find a YouTube video that will be 11 minutes and 19 seconds long. I will get on TikTok and the first video will have 1,119 likes. So it's very, it's like creepy stuff like that. It's not like I'm searching for it. Like I look at my phone like 18 times and like one of those times had 1119 or 119. It's literally like I walk into a room and in front of my eyes, like the clock will change to that number.
Right.
So it's been really strange and I've just kind of ignored it. Because to me, like whenever things repeat, like deja vu, all that stuff, I'm just like, oh, I'm on the right track. And it's just the universe giving me like a little pat on the back saying, hey, like we see you, we're here. But it's happened so, so much that it's just gotten really weird for me. And it hit me the other day that my grandma died on my birthday last year, which is November 19th.
11/19.
And the last thing I did before I moved was I burned a candle that used to belong to her that had her name on it. And I kind of just told myself, oh, you know, maybe it's my grandma. And I went out and I got groceries. As I came back from getting groceries, parked my car, my radio turned to 119, and I audibly said, stop it, Grandma. And at that exact moment, a huge tree branch snapped off of the tree above me and landed on my car.
Ah! Your grandma's like, you stop it, bitch. Oh my God, that's so cool.
At which point I said, sorry, Grandma. And got the branch off my car.
Whoa.
Yeah, so I'm not entirely sure what's going on with that. If she's letting me know she's here or if she's kind of lost, I wonder a little bit because she had dementia for the last like 5 or 6 years of her life. And like 90% of the decor in my house comes from my great-grandma and my great grandpa, like all my totem pole and my carvings, even the oven mitts that I use are hers. So it makes me wonder if, you know, she might be a little confused and I have so much of her stuff that she wanted over here.
Oh, that's so interesting.
And she did die on my birthday. So,
yeah. Do you know what is very weird that I was thinking about while you were talking when you just said that, like maybe she's confused, like maybe she doesn't know exactly like what she's trying to communicate, but like I'm gonna talk about that today with my story.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess like not to like take over the conversation, but I do think it's so cool how like we can get these messages that we don't understand. And like most people, you're obviously not most people, but like most people would never even have noticed that that they're seeing like the time at the same time every day, that they're like seeing those numbers everywhere. Like people do not notice that stuff.
No, not everyone does. Not everyone pays attention to it.
Right. And like I know you have like a special bond with your grandma, and like she obviously knew that you were a person who would notice that kind of stuff. I think it's so cool.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think that, you know, maybe her dying on my birthday created some sort of weird little link between us.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm going to keep my eyes open, see if it still happens. And then, of course, if I dream anything weird, because that's pretty much what always happens to me, is I just have weird dreams about things, about people.
Yeah, I have the dreams where I'm like, what the fuck when I wake up? Like, not meaningful in any way. Just like, forgot to water my baguettes.
Sarah forgot to water her baguettes. I'm over here like fucking meeting Moses and shit.
Yeah, and I'm just... I have a very complicated garden in my dreams, and I am struggling to care for it. In real life, though, I just harvested not one, not two, but three cherry tomatoes.
Ooh, look at you.
Three whole cherry tomatoes after months of work.
Labor.
Bought the plant for like $5 and just like the soil for another $5, and then just like 3 months of like pruning and watering
for one mouthful of cherry tomatoes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're delicious, and you know, it gives me a reason to step outside for 10 seconds a day, and really that's all I could ask for.
It's true.
Because without it, I wouldn't.
I definitely don't go outside as much now that my front door is not connected to the outside.
Mm-hmm.
I run into too many people like in the stairwell, and it's weird, and I don't like it.
Same. I used to listen to see if people were in the hallway before I left my apartment.
Mm-hmm. I live with a lot of couples, it seems like. I always see like a chick and a dude and their dog. And that's like every other tenant other than me.
Couples with dogs. I had a lot of those too, because my building was like pet friendly or so they mm-hmm. say. And then they charge you like $250 for pet rent or whatever the fuck, which I got out of because the guy who interviewed me thought sitting I was on hot. You
or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, oh, I'll take it. I mean, and then the other guy who took over after that guy was fired was like, yeah, we're really not supposed to do that, but I guess since it's in your lease, we'll like keep it on there. I'm like, okay, sounds good. I forgot where I was going with that. Oh, the couple below me would just like beat the shit out of each other on the regular. Like,
I wonder how they're doing.
Hopefully she's in jail. Because she was a danger to society.
Mm-hmm. I think about them sometimes.
She was the instigator. I could tell just by listening. And then I saw them one time and I was like, yep, it's her. She's the problem.
She knocks him around. Yes. Not good.
Yeah. I mean, neither way is good, but
no,
it's just sad.
Yes.
Anyway.
On that light note.
Domestic violence, you know. The huge. Welcome back to Saints and Witches. I'm Sarah. I'm Catholic.
I'm Liz. I'm a witch.
And today we're coming to you live. Not live. Close enough to live. And we're going to talk about Saints and Witches.
In Switzerland.
In Switzerland. No, in Switzerland. I did not know that Switzerland was not a country until like pretty recently.
I don't know anything about anything until I start reading about it. So mm-hmm. Sorry, Switzerland.
I always just assumed that like, oh yeah, Switzerland was probably around before the United States because like it's in Europe.
Yeah, but they were like a weird confederacy or something for a long time. Yeah. Yeah, I got into reading about like women's rights for some reason. It was vaguely relevant to my story and fell down a small rabbit hole of Switzerland and was like, you were not entirely the country that I thought you were.
What's up, Switzerland? What are you hiding? We're going to find out.
What's behind the curtain?
What's behind curtain number one? Switzerland. We have new listeners in Colombia. Bienvenidos.
Hello, hello, hello.
Yeah. And we now have listeners in 41 states plus Washington, D.C.
Well, which states are missing? Because I will drive there and personally kick someone's ass.
I don't know. I'm not going to guess. That would be ridiculous. It's a ridiculous thing to expect of me. No, I'm not sure, but I will look it up and I will get back to you and we can post it on Instagram and call out those specific states.
We will shame them specifically.
Yeah, then they'll want to listen. It's a weird tactic.
But it might just work.
It just might.
So we are in Switzerland. Do you know what the best thing about Switzerland is?
Their cheese.
No, their flag's a big plus.
Love that. Cute.
Switzerland makes me think of Twilight. Like, that's my immediate association because I have brain rot. Whenever she declares herself Switzerland, she's not going to pick a side.
Oh, you know, I think I read the first book. No, I didn't finish it. I got halfway through the first book. You know how, like, in middle school when Twilight was, like, a really big thing, you either, like, everybody made it their personality, whether you loved it or you hated it. I was on the hating it side. It was my personality was hating it.
I read it. Liked it while I was reading it, got done reading it, couldn't figure out why I had read it because it seems so dumb. And then I like never thought about it again. But I like the Twilight movies because they're just so fucking stupid. And for some reason, they're like the perfect background noise.
Yeah. And the visuals are nice. Like, yeah. I do love the mood.
They have a pretty chill vibe to them. I like their vibe.
And the soundtrack is great.
So yeah, whenever I just need something on in the background, sometimes I'll just turn on the Twilight series. Anywho, there are other things that I should think of when I think of Switzerland.
Besides Kristen Stewart.
Yes. Should not be my immediate association. Well, like, there's so many cool fucking mountains in Switzerland. And
that's true.
I wrote out a whole bunch of stupid shit like chocolate and watches and
chocolate.
Knives.
I was going to say chocolate too, but I decided on cheese because I thought it would be funnier.
But then after that, I put, I don't know, like that's the full list of things that I could think of. Nothing else I could think of in Switzerland, which I realize sounds ignorant, but I've been enjoying this series of TikToks lately with Europeans not realizing how big the U.S. is and like why we're so bad at our own geography, like let alone everybody else's.
True.
So like we have 6 time zones in the U.S., which is absolutely fucking ridiculous. You're in the same state as me and you're 7 hours away, which is crazy. You could drive through so many countries in Europe in 7 hours.
Yeah, it's true.
So I'm as clueless about Switzerland as I am about Oregon. As far as I'm concerned, Oregon is just knockoff Washington. I don't know anything about Oregon.
Well, yeah, any state that's like that far away might as well be a foreign country. Like,
what the fuck is Montana? No idea.
I don't know. I would like to move to Montana, but I know nothing about it.
They got some pretty pictures on Google Images. That's all I know.
Probably got a lot of cattle.
Yeah, maybe some cowboys. I don't know.
Maybe some gay cowboys. Love that.
Love that for them.
Love that journey.
I truly have no concept of most of the U.S. states outside of like stereotypes. So anywho, I will be talking about a woman named Anna Goldie today, or Goldin, or the Goldin woman. There is a lot of juicy material to work with in Switzerland. You've got the werewolf witch trials, the bloodbath that was the Valais witch trials, but I ended up swinging to the last witch execution in the country. Because the writer in me has like a really soft spot for characters and story, like actual people on a stage, small cast, backstory, moving parts. So while large witch hunts can be really fun, I have to be in the mood for that kind of like dense academic research that's kind of like really distant from people.
Yeah, that's true.
And never you fear, though, I will be back to Switzerland in the future to talk about the absolute, like, shit show that they had going on witch-wise. Because there's so much stuff there.
Cool.
My huge ass disclaimer, we've kind of talked about this before I dive in today. If you look up Anna, you're going to find a bunch of articles with like three paragraphs on her. And like, that's it. That's like where they max out.
Mm-hmm.
I ran into one source that went on for 17 pages.
Oh my God.
And I was like, oh my God, this is a fucking gold mine. This is great. Only for the translator to toss in at the very end. By the way, this is mostly from a fiction novel.
Oh my God.
The translator explained that the author, and I'm paraphrasing the translator's words here, leaned heavily on historical fact and documents and didn't really attempt to write the spaces in between those facts or those events.
Okay.
The translator also says the author didn't write any romance scenes, even though the opportunity was there several times. I got the impression it was not like The Devils of Loudun, looking at you, Aldous Huxley, you fucking Irving on the A-Simp. Jesus Christ, those long-winded passages about how fucking hot he was.
I can't believe during that episode I never figured out that you were talking about Aldous Huxley. Like it, the guy who wrote Brave New World. And it never connected in my mind until later.
That's okay, it never connected for me either. I was like, this dude sucks. And later it's like, oh, I didn't realize, so I was insulting.
He actually, I mean, but Brave New World is fiction, so there's a difference.
I feel like I'm fine with insulting, like, white dudes who wrote, like, classic literature as long as I know who I'm insulting. Like,
yeah, he'll be fine. Also, he was on so many drugs. Like, he cannot be held responsible for anything he wrote. I don't even understand how he physically did it.
It's a mystery.
Yeah.
Miraculous.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I don't read German, so I can't verify anything the translator claims. So I think I did end up finding one copy of the book that I could have downloaded, but again, it was in German. And then the only one that I found in English, it had been reported to Amazon for like having so many like formatting errors and typos.
It was
like $11. So it's like, no, I'll just take the translator's words for what happens.
Yeah.
Also, this translation seemed to be an article, and I kind of had to piece this together because it never comes out and says it anywhere. The translation seemed to be of an article written about the novel cut through with the historian's book.
Okay.
So, like, while it's talking about the novel, like, occasionally referencing this historian saying, like, he found this stuff here, and this is the facts to back it up.
Okay.
So to break that the fuck down, a woman writes a book, fiction, a man writes a book, academic, someone writes an article synthesizing their facts, not in English, somebody translates that article. That's what the fuck I read.
Okay, I understand.
I couldn't really find the documents the article references other than one. The translation was either really vague about like the document, author, publication, year, or my searches were just fruitless in general. And it's noted over and over across several articles anyway that the trial was hushed up and most of its court records were destroyed to erase the case. So that doesn't particularly surprise me. So my story source for today, almost 95%, is that article that I mentioned, and it uses facts from the fiction novel, comes from, and I'm gonna fuck up both of these names, I'm gonna fuck up everything I try to say in this story, and it's because for most of it I can only find like the German pronunciations, and I know that Swiss German is slightly different. Eveline Hausler is the fiction novelist and Walter Hauser is the historian slash journalist who wrote the academic book that it was spliced with. If my facts are wrong, go yell at them because I'm just a middleman. So let's dive into Anna Gulli, whose birth date is October 24th, 1734, by some sources. She is born to a poor mother and father, who we do not know the names of. We know nothing about Anna's mother at all, so it goes.
Yep.
But Anna's father was a knife grinder and a, I didn't look up how the fuck to say this, sacristan.
Oh, sacristan.
Sacristan. Emphasis on the wrong syllable.
Yeah. Right. So he like cleans all the chalices and stuff after mass. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's one of those dudes.
Mm-hmm. I did that. Not to brag.
Not to compare yourself with Anna's poor father or anything.
Right. I mean, I'm no knife grinder.
I'm no peasant knife grinder or anything.
Right.
The family lives in the Sinwald municipality in the canton of St. Gallen. That's northeastern Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
As Anna grows up, she starts working as a servant here and there in different households. And side note, I could not be a servant because I have far too much hostility for the rich.
Oh my God.
If I had to work for somebody who could afford a servant, like just right there, I already want to murder them.
I would steal so much stuff.
I would steal all their shit.
And I steal from work anyway.
I have stolen a lot of office supplies. Anyway, Anna is described in a warrant as, quote, rotund and tall, her face without scars or other imperfections, with a rosy complexion, black hair and eyebrows, and gray eyes, end quote.
Everything except for rotund was great.
Sometimes she has brown eyes. Sometimes she's called stately or beautiful in fiction. But, and this is what I wrote, they always hit on the rotund or the amply proportioned, which I take to mean that she thick. She fine.
Shoddy thick. As they say.
Who's they? I don't know.
Who knows?
It's not me. It's awkward in my mouth for sure.
Yeah, it's definitely not me.
No. The warrant does say she dresses well for her standing. As Anna gets older, she gets into a series of mishaps. If my math is correct, and I think it is, in 1765, around the age of 31, while she's working as a servant in Sinwald, she takes up with a man who gets her pregnant, and he enrolls in the army and he leaves her behind.
Wow.
Unwed.
Okay.
Every article I run into says that this is her first child, but the one original document I have, the advertisement offering a reward for Goldie's arrest in 1782, I'm pretty sure it says that this is her middle child.
Hmm.
The actual document is not translated that I could find, but the description underneath it where it says, like, this is in essence what this says, mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure it says three children, the middle of which I'm getting ready to tell you. So I'm uncertain if there's another child we don't know about, what's going on, why no other source mentions this, but I feel like throwing it out there.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem is not so much that Anna is pregnant out of like wedlock. The problem is that Anna has the baby, and that night, the first night, it suffocates in its sleep.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Which as a mother, that would be super terrible. Like you're dealing with this immense guilt of, you know, did I do something wrong? Did I lay the baby down wrong? Mm-hmm. Was there something wrong with my baby?
Yeah.
You know, is this my fault? Is it not my fault? But you know, either way, like this is my baby that I've carried around for like 9 months and now it's dead.
Yeah. Side note, I was watching a TikTok and this woman was like, I can't stand when people like mommy blogs and stuff will be like, hey, if you kept your kid alive, you're doing great. It's like, well, thanks. Like my baby died.
Yeah. Like, what do you
like,
do?
Like, how
if
am
baby
I?
Has like SIDS or whatever.
How am I doing, mama? Like that fucking sucks. So yeah, that's terrible. That's horrific.
Oh, my child got leukemia. I guess I'm a terrible parent.
Right. Exactly. It's like, damn, I never even thought about that.
Also, why is the bar that fucking low? As long as you're keeping them alive.
Right. Well, that's what you say to like make yourself feel better so you can sleep at night. Well,
that's definitely what some of my family said to themselves when they were raising me.
Well.
She's still breathing.
Right. Exactly. parenting.
anyway. you're dealing with all of this. While you're dealing with all of this, the town sweeps in for Anna and convicts her as a murderer.
Great.
Without a trial. Puts her in the pillory and sentences her to 6 years of house arrest. So,
wow.
It reminds me too much of the thing that, like, keeps trying to be passed in states here that, like, if you have a miscarriage, you can be arrested, which is, like, the stupidest fucking bill.
That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. Also, like, I know what you're talking about, and they, like, wanted to make it so that, like, if the doctor doesn't try to save your ectopic pregnancy,
which is, like, they'll lose their license.
It's impossible. It's literally written by men who know absolutely nothing about, like, women's reproductive health.
No, they know absolutely fucking nothing. For anybody who doesn't live in our country, go read about some of the stupid fucking things happen over here occasionally. It's really dumb. But yeah, her baby dies and the town is like, and we're going to convict you as a murderer.
Great.
Yes, but Anna says, fuck this noise, to the house arrest, and she escapes and flees to a canton called Glarus in the east. And a canton, I don't even know if I'm saying that correctly, because I couldn't find anybody to say it online for me, even though it's like a fucking vocabulary word. If you look up canton, they're like, here it is in Chinese. It's like, this is Switzerland. Tell me how to say it in Switzerland.
Probably because it is just canton. Like, you know, like, it's probably easy.
You would think. And then I can't even say the word that I said earlier about the church dude correct. So, well, I don't trust myself.
Yep.
Words are tricky.
They are tricky.
Anyway, a canton is like a state. Like the closest equivalent. It has constituencies in it, which are like districts, which have towns. Here in the town of Mulis, she takes up as a maid for some rather important fellows. And now it's important to know that Switzerland at this time is maybe not a great place to be prosecuted. I'm trusting my source here because I didn't have time to unpack the history of Switzerland. You kind of talked about, like, Switzerland as a country and everything. This is what I kind of avoided getting into, and I heavily relied on my source, so I didn't have to get into it.
Yeah.
it's complicated.
Mm-hmm.
So the historian Hauser, and I'm just going to quote the translator for expediency here, quote, Switzerland at the time was not a democracy, but a feudal society. There were 13 sovereign territories, which were oligarchies. Jurisdiction was in the hands of the executive power, the council, mm-hmm. and the highest member of the administration, Landamman, who was the highest judge. The translator, sometimes their grammar isn't always correct, but that's okay, because they speak more languages than I do. The counselors were in their office for life and had absolute power.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's great.
That's fantastic.
It reminds me too much of how we appoint, like,
the Supreme Court.
Yeah, that we're just like, here you go. Like,
you'll be great forever.
We're just gonna put you here and you can do whatever you want.
You can make whatever decisions your little heart desires.
Women will not have the right to vote for about another 200 years.
Great.
They don't get the right to vote until I think it's the 1970s.
Mm.
And society is kind of puritanical, traditional, patriarchy, but like whatever kind of words you want to throw in there, you want to use however you want to think about it. But the article mentions like unwed mothers wearing red caps, adultery is illegal.
Yikes. So
like, yeah, very strict. And even whenever I was reading about women's rights, they say that there's still a like workforce really isn't set up for them to be breadwinners. And they're trying to change that, and they finally appointed some women into like really high positions, and
oh, that's good.
Yeah, so it seems like things are getting better and that they will change, but you know, you come out of something like this, it's not an immediate change, especially when they've only had the right to vote for like what, 50 years?
Yeah, and that that was surprising to me when you said that. Like, I always think of America as being kind of like the least progressive developed country.
Yeah. I think we were too focused on race. I think that that was our top thing, that whenever it came to like women getting the right to vote and everything, they're like, you know what? There are some white people in that group over there of women. There are white women. So
true. That's probably exactly true.
Yeah. So
I'm just thinking, I forgot we were recording for a second. I just started like thinking about like life and politics and tragedy.
It's hard to avoid in this show.
Yeah. Usually it's so far back though that it's like, whatever, it's not really real. Which is how I think about all of history before like 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
the big thing is that in GLOSS, and this comes from Walterhauser, it is controlled by two families as small towns, and it's not a town, but as small towns tend to be controlled by families. So, you know, like the smaller the area, the longer that a family has been instilled in the area, the more money that the family has, the more control that they're going to have over something, and generally not in like the most legally sound of ways.
Right.
In GLOSS, it's the Chudis and the Zwickis. Those are the two families that are in power.
Mm-hmm.
I would say don't forget those names, but it's going to be impossible for you to forget them because I'm going to say them 5,000 times.
Great.
If it was a drinking game where you had to take a shot every time I said Chudi or Zwicky in Honest Story, you'd be dead like 3 times over.
Alcohol poisoning.
Yeah, so don't do it.
Don't do that.
Not that you were going to. Who the fuck would play a drinking game with our show? We should create a drinking game with our show.
I would play while recording. It would be bad.
Sarah gets progressively more incoherent as we go along.
Hey, it's happened before. Let's not pretend that it hasn't.
So one of Anna's employers in 1768 is a Zwicky family. They have a son named Melchior Zwicky, which is a hell of a fucking name.
Yeah.
Like Melchior.
That's a whole name.
That's a lot. That's a lot to saddle on a kid.
Yeah. Yes.
There is a big class disparity between Anna and Melchior, so even though they seem to be in love and have an affair that results in a son in 1775, marriage is impossible. And saying 1775 is so weird because I know that like our country's doing stuff at this time.
Oh my gosh, it's like the Revolutionary War.
Yeah, we're just chilling over there like fucking killing people, and they're like, we can't get married because our class differences.
Oh, it's romantic.
People just living their lives all over the place.
It's crazy how the world just goes on.
It does. Some articles say that Anna gives her son away. Some articles say that he's taken away. Either way, he does disappear from her story after she leaves the Zwicky household in search of new employment.
Mm.
5 years later, she begins working for the family that's going to be her complete and utter downfall.
Oh, boy.
The head of the household is a physician and judge, Dr. Johann Jakob Chudi. You would think this name is unique. It is not. There are two Johann Jakob Chudis in this story.
Great.
Google the name. You'll find another Johann Jakob Chudi, a diplomat whose father, Johann Jakob Chudi, is a merchant.
Well, I guess it's John Jacob, right? That's like a total like rich boy, fancy ass name.
Yeah.
Like old money name.
That guy on Google, his mother has a female name also from this family, with the last name Zwicky. So genuinely just don't try to keep track of people by their names alone.
Okay.
This guy is Dr. Chudi. That is how I'm going to refer to him. That is how we will keep them separate.
Okay.
His wife is Elspeth, and one of his young daughters is Anna Maria. A year and a half after Anna begins her employment, she gets into an argument with Anna Maria, the story goes. And because we've been doing the show for like a year and a half, it will come as a surprise to neither of us that after this little fight between servant and rich little bitch, that needles are found in Anna Maria's milk and bread at breakfast October 19th, 20th, and 22nd.
Ooh. Needles like in your oatmeal. Oh my god. Yeah. So scary.
Anna is immediately accused of trying to hurt Anna Maria and is fired. So she goes to stay with a metalsmith named Rudolph, who I believe is married at this point. And Rudolph is a relative of the Zvickys. So like everyone is either a fucking Judy or a Zvicky or is related to one or both of them. Like I've just accepted that at this point. Rudolph tells Anna that she needs to go to the authorities about the situation because her wages are being withheld and her belongings and money, like her savings, are hostage at the Chudy house. Anna does, but who is the highest politician in Glarus? Johann Heinrich Chudy.
Oh my god.
And who is the highest clergyman? Johann Jakob Chudy.
Oh,
my source specifically says that Johann Jakob and Johann Jakob are closely related.
Oh, no way.
I never would have guessed.
Right.
So one is Dr. Chudy, the other I am henceforth calling the Camerarius. And that is also a guess at how you say that word. It's a title, like a capital C. It has to do with being, it's some clergy station. I don't know.
Okay.
Landman Chudy and the Camerarius tell Anna they more or less don't give a shit about her case and that she should go apologize to the doctor to get her stuff back, then fuck the fuck out of their canton because they just don't want to see her anymore. That's what she does between October 27th and 29th, 1781. She gets her stuff, she apologizes, she leaves, and she goes to stay with a relative in Saxe. This should be the end of everything. It is not. A month later, in Anna's absence, rich little girl Anna Maria gets sick again, having seizures that result in her left leg contorting, her left foot contracting against her body.
Ooh.
Nowadays, she might get diagnosed as like epileptic or something. But magically, her doctor father just cannot figure out what's wrong with her or heal her. And magically, she starts throwing up needles.
Ugh.
But she only does this when her mom and dad or the Camerarius are present. So who do we think gets accused?
I have a guess.
Would you like to lock in your answer?
Yes.
Anna. Anna is accused of bewitching the kid, and the evangelical council sends a courier with an order of arrest headed for Anna on November 26th, where she's staying off with her relative. But Melchior sends his own courier to warn Anna the arrest warrant is coming. And Rudolph tries to warn Anna too, but Dr. Chudy confiscates his letter. She has been sufficiently warned by Melchior. So Anna flees to, oh, fuck, I didn't look up that word at all. Durgersheim? I don't know.
Sure.
Sure. So maybe she flees to Durgersheim. If that's wrong, I'm sorry. I forgot to highlight it.
That's okay.
I was more concerned with the other word in this paragraph that terrifies me that's coming up soon. After she flees, Melchior and Rudolph are interrogated. When December 9th hits and Anna has not been successfully recovered, Dr. Chudy petitions for a public warrant of apprehension, which is issued on January 21st, 1782, and published in the, and this is the word that I have to guess on, Zürcher Zeitung, February 9th. That is the name of a newspaper, and I could not find anywhere that would pronounce it for me. Anyway, that's the document that I have and will upload a photo of. It gives a description of Anna, her crimes, and offers a reward for her capture.
Okay.
Dr. Chudy also asked the council that anyone related to Melchior's Vicky recuse themselves, which is like a brass balls fucking move, in my opinion, considering 75% of the council is his family.
Right. Yeah. So he's just like,
he's like the only conflict of interest there possibly is in this case.
Yeah.
Any of Zvicky's family sitting on the council.
Oh my gosh.
And all of his family nods vigorously. They're like, you're absolutely right. We can't see any other conflict of interest.
Oh my gosh. So scary to be in that situation.
It is. In Anna's absence, the case begins with Dr. Chudy and his wife giving testimony about Anna Maria. Anna's relative she stayed with after leaving Glarus is questioned. Anna Maria is questioned, including anyone who has seen the little girl throw up pins or have seizures. The text notes that outside of these things, Anna Maria was healthy, and that, again, her afflictions only happened when other people were watching, especially her mom and the Camerarius.
Yeah.
Anna Maria is examined by another doctor during the course of the case, a Dr. Marty, who just so happens to be an old classmate and friend of Dr. Chudy.
Oh, great.
Who sees nothing wrong with the good doctor's findings at all. He's like, you're absolutely right. She's just mysteriously vomiting pins. So it's obviously witchcraft.
Right.
The text criticizes them heavily. Most of the articles do too, saying that witchcraft was not a common belief anymore. This is the late 1700s.
Yeah, that is pretty late.
It's late, like enough that I can trace my family tree back this far really easily.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's only a couple generations back from like family members who were still alive when I was born.
Right.
So it's believed that they had an agenda, which I will get to. Anna is found, arrested, and hauled back to Glarus in February of 1782 on the 21st. So she comes back to this theory from the two doctors that Anna Maria can only be healed by the witch who cursed her. So no medicine or anything that they do, anything that they give her is going to fix her.
Yeah.
But this is a double-edged sword, because if Anna can heal the kid, then it's proven that she's the witch who did it, that she is a witch.
Mm-hmm.
If she can't, they're just going to say that she's a witch who's so evil she won't even heal her child victim.
Right.
And like, she can't win. They're just going to call her a witch either way.
Right.
Anna has no choice but to attempt to heal the girl. And so she does. And when she touches Anna Maria, the little girl's contorted leg straightens out. And when she gives the girl medicine, Anna Maria's stomach stops hurting.
Magic.
Total magic. It really is just like, I think they called it a laxative. That's the translator though. So, but literally like just gave her like regular medicine to settle her stomach. And it's like, and she was cured. And it's like, did they even attempt to heal this little girl at all?
Like, oh, she drank the Pepto-Bismol from my very own hands.
Or did they treat Anna Maria like any woman in the 21st century who goes to the doctor and they're like, have you considered you're fat?
Have you considered you have a uterus?
My doctor tells me all the time I'm exaggerating.
Have you considered that you're fat? Oh, that's fucked up.
My foot was numb for like 8 months and he's like, I don't think it's anything. I think it's just kind of in your head and you're probably sitting wrong.
It's oh like, my God.
Okay. Whatever.
It's like, I mean, I'm definitely sitting wrong, but
anyway, this is the beginning of the end for Anna. A month later, on the 18th, Anna Maria testifies kind of out of nowhere that Anna gave her a cookie. I am assuming that this means that the cookie was like the root of what caused the whole like needle vomit seizure curse.
Yeah.
The translator or the person who wrote the article like really just hops over to this information. I don't know how we got here. We skip some steps.
Mm-hmm.
Anna Maria also says that Rudolph, which is that metalsmith, was there when it happened, and Anna Maria really didn't know Rudolph, which is the first sort of indicator for historians that something is going on here that's not entirely above board.
Mm-hmm.
One historian suggests a council member, Balthazar Chudy, because everyone's a fucking Chudy, mentioned these names to Anna Maria during her questions, probably in a way that you're not supposed to do. Like, did Rudolph have anything to do with this?
Right. As objection.
Yeah, as opposed to, did anyone other than Anna have something to do with this?
It's like showing the victim a picture and then showing them like a lineup of people.
Yeah, it's the thing that you're not supposed to do in a photo lineup and like tell them that they're there.
Yeah.
Make sure you pick out the one who's here that absolutely is here.
Right. yeah. That's what they did on Making a Murderer.
Yeah, not good. Mm-hmm. Some stupidity like that
mm-hmm.
probably took place. And Anna Maria latched onto it and these names and probably started repeating them back and using them in her stories.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, they start torturing Anna for confessions, which legally they can do up to 3 times, I guess, which, you know, goody on them for putting a fucking legal limit on torture.
Only 3 times. And see, if I was being tortured, I'd be like, okay, I can do this only 2 more times.
But like, what are the finer stipulations? Like, how long is the torture session? What objects are you allowed to use?
That's interesting.
Because is it like a fucking filibuster where they can just keep swapping out people and they can make one session last like 42 days?
Torture filibuster. As long as you don't sit down.
It's just one session.
That's really dark. I love it.
Anyway, Anna is tortured, hung up by her thumbs with stones tied to her feet. I'm sure other methods of torture were used. I came across the strappado and swimming a witch and other fun stuff reading about the Swiss, because like the Germans, they just really loved torturing their witches.
Mm-hmm.
Under torture, Anna confesses to Anna Maria's account of what happened, recants, confesses again, changes her story when Anna Maria randomly changes her story so that they match again. Yeah. Do you imagine this little girl can't remember what she said, and every time she changes her story, you get like the shit beaten out of you again until you make it match?
Oh my God. God, I would strangle that fucking kid.
Yeah. She's only like 8 or something, too.
I'm picturing the little girl from Willy Wonka. Like, oh, I wanted to punch that kid in the face so bad.
Yes.
Daddy, I want a squirrel.
So Anna Maria changes her story and says that Rudolph is the one who made the cookie now, instead of like Anna did it and Rudolph was just there. So now Rudolph is interrogated about this several times, and he confesses and recants and confesses and recants and confesses and recants. But on the 12th of May, having had enough, he finally hangs himself in his prison cell.
Jeesh.
Authorities cut the right hand off of his corpse, nail it to the gallows, and bury him at the execution site.
What the heck?
Yeah. I don't know why they cut his hand off.
Just for fun.
Just for funsies.
They were just in a silly, goofy mood.
They just saw his body and they're like, hey, what if we chopped his hand off and like nailed it to the gallows?
Just to see.
Just to see what happened.
Yeah.
Anyway, 7 days later, after Rudolph hangs himself, is Anna's final interrogation, where she pleads for mercy. At some point over the course of the interrogations, she had confessed to the devil appearing to her as a black dog, which we've heard a million times, mm-hmm. and to giving her the needles, which is something that we've also heard before with the, was it Isabel with like the elf shot, the elf arrows and stuff?
Oh, yeah, like whatever weapon was used, it was given to me by the devil.
Yeah. So this is not even like unique stuff. It's very much just a stop torturing me. I'll say the things I've heard a million times before. Other things we've seen before, accounts that the accused witch didn't cry or seem to feel much pain during torture, that crops up here in Anna's story. I gave a rant once about this being a convenient way to divorce women from their humanity before slaughtering them. And I still completely stand by that. So they will say that, you know, she murdered her baby, that baby that she had. And then she tortured this little girl by putting like pins in her food and stuff. And then she didn't even cry whenever they tortured her.
Right.
And it's like, sounds like a bunch of bullshit to me.
Right. Like, I mean, she was like hanging by her thumbs. Like, she probably cried.
Yeah. I know women can withstand a lot of pain, but
a lot more than men can.
We can withstand a lot of fucking pain. Mm-hmm. But yeah, she definitely would have fucking cried if she's being tortured enough that she's confessing to stuff and then recanting later, mm-hmm. and then confessing again when she gets tortured again.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's bothering her enough that she feels compelled to speak to make it stop.
Yeah.
Anywho, on May 31st, Dr. Chudy wants it to be noted officially in the case that he has never had sex with Anna. At which point, we pretty much discover the entire reason for Anna's persecution.
Uh-oh.
It's technically a theory, but I think it's a pretty sound one. The theory is that Dr. Chudy was having an affair with Anna, which is not wholly unreasonable, seeing as she'd had an affair with Melchior Zwicky working for his household.
Right.
Fearing the affair being outed, Switzerland kind of had that moral stick up its ass, which would mean losing his office, his standing, the honor of his family. The text notes that this happened to these Vickys during the trial, presumably because Melchior's affair with Anna came to light.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Chudy conceivably could have gotten Anna accused of witchcraft, not only to discredit her as a person, but to get her executed in one of the few legal avenues that he had available to him. And also, he would have had a chance to put it down to record in court that he never touched her. So not relying on rumors, but having it officially documented in a court that I never had an affair with this woman.
I believe it.
I fully believe it too. And this is one of the articles that I was reading. I was reading about this theory when I found that guy in the comment section who was like, or you don't know the whole story and he could have been a good guy and she could have been like a murderous fucking maniac.
Ooh, hot take. Exactly the thing they killed her for. What a hot take. Wow. Thank you.
It's like, Bob, have you ever read about any other fucking witch trial in history, or did you just stumble across this one and decide that you knew everything?
Wow, Bob's a historian.
He really is. I don't even remember what his name was. I didn't care that much. He mm-hmm. made that little impact on my life.
Mm.
Next week, I won't remember him at all. Anna ends up being convicted for poisoning, not witchcraft, with 32 votes for and 3 against. I was surprised it was so close with the Chudys more or less ruling the council.
Mm-hmm.
But at the age of 48 years old, on June 13th, 1782, Anna is led to the public square, where she is decapitated with a sword and buried under the gallows.
Jeez.
The Camerarius, who apparently cannot read a fucking room, delivers a sermon at her grave about sinners and asks God be merciful with Anna. And I swear to fuck, if a powerful family orchestrated my death and then one of them had the audacity to stand on my grave and call me a sinner, I would haunt the shit out of them and their kids and their kids, 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 kids.
Yeah.
I am a creature of spite and time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely like that would be a good movie. Where like you're on the family side the whole time, but then like one of the family members finds out the real story of like why they're being haunted. That's super fucked up.
It is. Because Anna is convicted for poisoning, some don't consider her the last witch executed in Switzerland. And also the last witch executed in Europe is another title that I saw given to her. But because her trial focused so heavily on Satan, a kid magically vomiting needles, like the black dog, the devil gave it to me, like it was a witch trial and everything, but like name in conviction. So a lot of people do count it. Rudolph and his widow have their, Rudolph who's dead by the way, and his widow have their estate confiscated. The wife has to pay a fine for a letter she wrote to her imprisoned husband. Like, what a fucking dick move.
Wow.
Melchior has to pay a fine for warning Anna about her arrest. All in all, Glarus made several thousand Swiss francs off of Anna's trial.
Right, of course.
Mm-hmm. That's what happens in a lot of cases, is that there was a lot of motivation for these witch hunts because they could confiscate people's wealth, they could confiscate their properties, and either the city could keep them or they could go to the people that wanted them, but they were extremely lucrative.
I mean, yeah, we're doing that still here with, like, drug offenses. Take all their shit.
It's dumb. We don't learn. We're still terrible.
Yep.
Melchior gets banned from politics. His family kind of is ruined. But Dr. Chudy walks away completely fine because, you know, he had it noted in the trial that he is a completely honorable man. But in a bout of poetic justice, most of his family involved in the trial dies shortly after the trial, including his wife.
Love that.
So it's his wife, Landemann Schutte, the Camerarius, and then the Camerarius's sons. All of them die within, I want to say, like 6 years after the trial. It's but a very short span of time.
But he doesn't die?
He dies in 1800. So not that much. It's what, 18 years later?
Yeah.
Is my math on that
correct? I don't know. I said yeah, but I have no clue.
She dies in 1782. He dies in 1800.
Yeah.
He lives a little bit longer, but not mm-hmm. a huge amount of time longer. The trial, by and large, we don't have much information on. We don't have as much information as we could. Ridiculed for believing in witchcraft and more or less hounding and slaughtering this woman, the authorities and Glarus squashed a lot of the trial. The text says they blocked historians from looking at records and that the trial records mysteriously vanished in the meantime.
Oh, geez.
And only partials were found later and archived. A town in Glarus dedicated its museum to Anna, and on the 225th anniversary of her death, a member of parliament called for her exoneration. Mm-hmm. There was some controversy over wanting to acquit her. It would mean admitting fault, for one. But I read a BBC article where school kids were interviewed, and they were talking about how, you know, the past needs to just be the past. They don't need to dig everything back up, and you don't always need to be responsible for everything. And I think this is the article that was talking about how... something about like the Swiss turning away people in one of the world wars, maybe it was World War II, and they still don't entirely take responsibility for having done that either. That, you know, being a neutral party doesn't necessarily mean that there's not blood on your hands.
Yeah, that's true.
So it draws a comparison between those two things. In later 2007, Parliament does acknowledge the case as a miscarriage of justice, and the cantonal administration follows suit a year later. The text says Anna is remembered with special events every June, and Zurich Tourism has special city tours following her last days. There is a movie that comes from Hausler's book, but I couldn't track the full thing down, and it's not in English. The trailer is on YouTube, though, and it's pretty easy to follow, like, even though it's not in English and there aren't subtitles. Mm-hmm. If you know the gist of her story, very easy to just follow what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the story of Anna Goldi, maidservant, mother, mistress, and another poor woman chewed up and spit out by the rich.
Man, that's sad. And like, when you were talking about like how strict, not strict, but like how like puritanical Switzerland was for such a long time, even like recently, like unwed mothers having to wear like red clothing, like what I was thinking was like, even if she did kill her baby, it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
She freaked out. I mean, that's not good, but like, you could see why.
Either way, her life would have been fucked. I mean, either she's accused as a murderer, she's on house arrest, she's put in the pillory, blah, blah, blah. Or, you know, she's walking she's around like as an unwed mother, which is this badge of fucking shame.
Yeah. It's like you put, as a society, you put people in these like horrible positions and then you punish them when they do, when they make a choice, like between two bad choices. Like, fuck. Oh, that sucks. In my mind, she got to live happily ever after with Melchior.
I think that they were kind of adorable, and I think he might have been married because it's phrased as an affair, but just the fact that, like, he goes out of his way to, like, warn her and gets involved in the trial and, like, loses all of his honor and everything, like, I think he has to have legitimately cared about her.
It's
gone to that effort.
Very romantic to lose your honor.
Yeah. And I think Rudolf has to have been a good friend to have also tried to warn her. And I mean, he was really just this like auxiliary character over on the side. So I think that it says a lot for Anna that she had these people who are willing to risk their lives and their freedom for her.
Yeah, I mean, you don't do that for somebody you don't care about.
You don't do that for a despicable, murderous person. No. And I mean, whenever she was leaving, she's like had relatives and stuff to stay with. So obviously she wasn't like this outcast or anything. She had a network of people who liked her and that she could depend on.
Right. It just wasn't enough against like all rich these people. Rich, powerful men.
Yeah. Named
John Jacob, whatever the fuck. John Jacob Henry.
Jingleheimer Smith.
John Jacob Jingleheimer Schmidt.
His name is my name too.
You know, whenever we go out, it's literally every time we go out the people shout, here comes John Jacob Jingleheimer Schmidt.
Oh, we should move on.
Yeah. I'm talking about a bit of an unknown today, which is always great for me because no one's going to be like, well, actually.
We'll try it anyway.
Well, but they don't know who this is. So I can pretty much say whatever I want. I think one episode I will just like make a saint up.
I'll make a witch up.
That will be great.
We'll warn nobody.
Yeah, we're not going to tell anybody which episode it is. We'll make Wikipedia entries for both of them.
They only have to be a couple paragraphs long and look legit.
True. Yeah, there are a million saints whose Wikipedia is like one paragraph. This one, it's like, I would say it's like five paragraphs, which is like short for a saint.
Long for a witch.
Yeah. So I was looking up Swiss Roman Catholic saints and I could only find a few, but that's just because, like we said, Switzerland wasn't Switzerland for a long time. So, saints who are from the area that's now Switzerland might not be considered like Swiss saints, but they technically are. So today we're talking about Saint Ida or Ida of Toggenburg. There are a few different Saint Idas or Saint Idas or Saint Itas or like it's the root name is Judith, which is weird. but it's all the same name, like Ita, Yuta, Judith, it's all the same. So this Saint Ida, I'm going to say Saint Ida, I don't know if that's right, but I know it's what I'll come back to saying, so I'm just going to go with it. This Saint Ida is the only one from the area that will later be known as Switzerland. My sources are, unfortunately, complicated. Wikipedia led me to believe that the first hagiography about Saint Ida was written by this guy named Albrecht of Bonstetten, I think, who was the dean of Fischingen Abbey in the 1480s. I found out by reading the free preview of a $70 ebook that was not true, in fact, that Albrecht had in fact summarized and expanded on an even earlier hagiography, and that one I could not find. I found Albrecht's, but it was only in Latin and German. So I read a summary of it, which had like some excerpts. And then I read a text that claimed to be an English translation. And I will synthesize those two main sources. Here's the thing. The English quote unquote translation is clearly not just a translation. Not to be a bitch, but it kind of reads like a story written by a creative writing 101 student who is obsessed with Grimm's fairy tales. It's fan fiction, which I prefer over, like, for example, fan fiction of Nietzsche. The fairy tale sluts are fine by me. The philosopher sluts, not so much.
That is a lot of them that go professional.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many things you could be obsessed with. Why that? Why that one? Why existentialism as a personality trait?
Pick something else. It's so dull.
Yes. So it's not a translation, but it is like a reimagining, I guess I would call it. And at first I was like, ugh. This is a waste of time. I don't want to read it. But then as I kept reading, I was like, you know, like, who am I to dismiss this just because it's not like polished and it wasn't written by a scholar? It's still technically a hagiography. It's a story about the life of a saint. And it's based in like that whole tradition. So it was interesting because it got me thinking about like all kinds of storytelling tradition and the kinds of stories and storytellers that we privilege over the ones that we don't and how that's changed throughout history. And I feel like we see this all the time on our show and both of our stories where it's like, I don't know who this author is. I don't know how accurate this information is, but people read it. People believed it. It was entertaining then, and it's entertaining now. So I just think that's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the author of the fanfic makes a note that they had been inspired to write it after having visited St. Ida's tomb, at which they felt, quote, a deep spirit of prayer and peace. And they say directly that this is a romanticized version of Albrecht's hagiography, which is funny because in the preface of Albrecht's hagiography, which he addressed to the abbot of Fishingen Abbey, he says that he has two purposes. One, to inspire devotion to Ida, and two, to entertain his readers. So they're both these authors are like, yeah, it's just a really good story. So like, this is what medieval people read. They read hagiographies, they read chivalric romances. Like, this is kind of like popular storytelling at the time. Historically accurate? Who's to say? maybe this is not going to be your favorite episode if you're really worried about historical accuracy. Just a warning.
Have we ever been worried about historical accuracy on the show? No.
I was very worried about World War II because that was so recent. But I think I did an okay job on it. So, I mean, yeah, I don't like lose sleep over it. I did the night before, but not anymore. Okay, so let's get into it. Ida, our girl, was born circa 1140, we think, near the city of Ulm, which is now part of Germany. I also didn't look up any pronunciations, but I'm going to guess. I think I have good guesses for all of them. So she was born near the city of Ulm, which is now part of Germany. She was the daughter of the Count of Kirchberg or Kirchenberg. The fanfic does not begin with Ida, though. It begins with the Count of Toggenburg, who in later manuscripts is named Heinrich or Henry. In the original text, he doesn't have a name. He's just the Count of Toggenburg. The fanfic says that Heinrich was surveying his domain. He lived in Toggenburg Castle, which was this like beautiful mountain fortress in the Black Forest. He had everything he could possibly want except a wife. So he set out on horseback to find himself a wife. And then just a quote so you can see like what the fanfic is like and what I'm talking about. Quote, one evening, as the sun gilded the beautiful spring landscape, Heinrich looked down from a hilltop onto the city of Ulm with its gables and towers. It seemed to reach up to the blue sky. Behind it, over the Danube, stood a proud castle. Blinded, Heinrich shaded his eyes with his hand. Could that be the castle of Kirchberg? Hope, curiosity, and a longing for adventure struggled in his heart. He felt drawn to that castle, dreaming of a noblewoman who would make a home for him and bring peace and serenity into his life. So you see what I mean.
I'm definitely, every time you say fanfic writer, I'm picturing a 12-year-old on Wattpad, so.
Right. Then we switch over to Ida's point of view in Kirchberg Castle, and we find out that her dad would really like her to get married, but that her dream is to become a nun. She fantasizes about living in a monastery and praying, being alone, finding fulfillment in daily chores that she currently doesn't have because she's a noblewoman. Again, this is the fanfic, not the hagiography. The hagiography hasn't even started yet at this point. So in the fanfic, Heinrich goes into the castle, meets Ida and her dad, and convinces Ida to marry him and come back to his castle with him. The fanfic makes it seem like she really was in love with him, and it was an added bonus that his castle was next to Fischingen Abbey so that she could go there whenever she wanted. So she would have traveled about 200 kilometers from home, not crazy far, not that like horrific trek through the mountains that those knights had to do with the baby St. Elizabeth, where they were like, we better not mess this up. And she had like 13 wagons of like jewelry and stuff.
Honestly, though, they could have lost her and just replaced her with a different kid. Like, who would have known?
Nobody would know. Right. All babies look the exact same. So it's not like crazy far, but it's like 12th century far, I would say. So now we skip ahead a little in the story and we go to the summary of the hagiography. It begins after Ida and Heinrich have been married for a while and Ida is living at Toggenburg Castle. One day she's doing the laundry. I guess she did that as a countess. And she sets her beautiful Arabian gold wedding ring out to dry in the sun and leaves it there. The sun reflects off the ring and it catches the eye of a raven who flies over and steals the ring. And
I was going to be a smart ass and say that a bird stole it.
Yep, you're correct. Yeah, a raven is like, yoink for me. Thank you so much. And puts it in its nest.
And is now the richest bird in all the land.
I am the wealthiest bird in the land. Oh, good for him. A few days later, one of Count Heinrich's hunters is out hunting, I assume, and finds the ring in the raven's nest. I don't know the logistics. Why did he climb the tree? How did he see it from the ground? Did he have a thing for birds? Was he looking for his penis in the nest?
He might have been. Not
sure. Very possible. The local witch might have placed his penis in the penis nest.
He was very disappointed to find the ring instead.
He's like, I guess I'll take this.
God damn it.
I mean, it fits, so I might
as well. My quest continues.
Exactly. So anyway, he found the ring and he was like, hell yeah, this is the perfect accessory. And he put it, quote, on his finger as if it were his own, unaware of its history, unquote.
Well, if I found a ring out in the middle of nowhere, I'd just be like, well, this is mine now.
I mean, yeah, who wouldn't? That's how Lord of the Rings, that's the plot.
I'm gonna go put an ad out in the paper for somebody to take it from me.
Right, exactly. It's like turning in money that you find on the ground. Like nobody really does it unless no. It's like insane, an insane amount of money, which in which case you should never touch it and you should back away slowly.
That's because, the blood of what? No Country for Old.
Yes, exactly. Because someone is watching you and they have a gun. So one of the Count's hunters is now wearing his wife's wedding ring. Not ideal. Of course, the hunter doesn't know that, but someone who does know the situation is one of the Count's servants. A servant sees the hunter wearing the ring and goes to the Count and is like, hey, quote, I have seen the nuptial ring of your wife on the finger of the hunter, and it leads me to believe that she gratified his desires and that he engaged in obscene fleshly delights with her. Obscene. Why were they obscene?
My brain went the other way. I was like, well, obviously he's married to the hunter now.
Oh, so cute. What if that's how it ended? And Ida's like, perfect, I'll go to the monastery. I never wanted to be here in the first place. And the servant points out like which hunter it is, like that guy. And Count Heinrich orders the hunter, quote, to be arrested and tied to the tail of a wild and unrestrained horse. He then drove the horse over the precipice of the mountains so that, thus torn apart, the hunter ended his life in agony. But Heinrich doesn't end his rampage there because, as they say, it takes two to tango. Never mind that there was no proof of any tango in the first place. It doesn't matter.
He didn't ask any questions of anyone at all. He just murder.
Zero to murder real quick. That's his move. So he goes and finds Ida and he throws her off of the highest point of the fortress down into the abyss below. Just yeets her off the castle wall. Goodbye. As Ida is falling, it's not funny. I don't know why I laughed, but I just picture like a cartoon, like you're falling for so long and you're passing by the same branch
over and over. Over and over. She's upside down, like checking her watch.
Exactly. She sees the raven on the way down. She's like, hey. As Ida is falling, she somehow has the presence of mind to say a prayer. And in the prayer, she tells God that if he saves her life, she will leave her husband, she will never marry again, and she will devote her whole life to God. And the hagiography says, quote, as she reached the ground, she was set whole and uninjured upon the earth. So now she's just chilling at the bottom of a giant ravine, and everybody thinks she's dead.
And she's at the bottom of the ravine like, I did not think this through.
I just picture her sitting for a second, just like,
It's much higher than I thought.
Looking all the way up, like,
is there a ladder? Fuck. Stairs?
Right.
Is there an elevator around here?
An elevator, yeah. So everybody thinks she's dead. She decides, well, okay, I'm already away from everybody, so I'm just going to live in this cave.
She doesn't try to leave.
She's like, okay, I guess this is where I'm supposed to be. So she lives in a cave and she survives on like berries and roots and stuff. Good for her, I guess. A problem I had with this story is, well, I have many problems, but one practical issue I had was I could not figure out the timing of anything. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know how long she's down there. I don't know how long she had been married before then. I don't know how old she was when she got married. Like, I don't know any of that. So I don't know if she's down there for like 5 years or if it's like a week. Like, I don't know.
She comes out. She has a castaway beard.
I literally made a castaway joke in the next paragraph. I'm still going to say it. So I don't know how long she's there, but sometime later, another hunter in the service of the Count is out with his dog and the dog picks up Ida's scent. So it can't have been like that long if the dog can smell her, I would think. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. And takes the hunter to the cave in the ravine and Ida's like full on caveman SpongeBob. Like she has a volleyball with a face painted on it. That was my castaway joke. And the hunter is like, cool.
He's gonna turn around and go the other way.
He's like, okay, you're alive. That is very chill information to find out. And he runs back to Count Heinrich and is like, so your wife that you tried to murder is alive. And Heinrich's like, no way. I killed her so good. Like, she is dead for real. But he is curious, so he follows the hunter back to the cave, which in my mind is kind of like a really dumb move.
But at the same time, the fact that they can like easily get down to this cave and she just chose to stay down there.
Oh yeah, she definitely wanted to be there.
Yeah, like, she did like not a clear exit out of this ravine, and she's like, no, this is my home now.
I'm good here. I don't need to be married anymore to that psychopath. Probably the smartest thing she ever did. So Heinrich is like, oh my god, suddenly I see the error of my ways, and I see that I was wrong for trying to murder you. Because if you really had cheated on me, then God wouldn't have spared your life. So you must be innocent and I must be the bad guy. It's like, yeah, you're the worst.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously. So Heinrich is like, please come home. Like, I will do the laundry. I will cook dinner. And you know what? Like, to top it all off, I will murder the servant who accused you of cheating on me. And I was like, oh my God.
He didn't fucking learn anything. Jesus Christ.
Learned absolutely nothing. And she says that she does not want anyone to be executed on her account. And she says, quote, I will not at all assent to your request that I inhabit our former home, for the yoke with which I was once joined to you in matrimony is invalid and non-binding. She's like, no, you tried to kill me. We're not married anymore. Like, our marriage dissolved when you tried to kill me. And Heinrich is like, what does that even mean? We're still married. Like, it's still legal. You're alive. And I was like, sorry, I should have led with this. I am now married to Jesus.
She joined the cult of married to Jesus.
Yes, she is one of those. So it's going to be a no from Ida. All she wants is for Heinrich to leave her alone in the cave. So she continues living in the cave. Again, I don't know how long. The hagiography says that every day Ida would walk from the cave to the abbey for matins while it was still dark in the morning through the scary black forest. But don't worry, she wasn't alone. Her companion on these walks was a stag with 12 candles hanging from its antlers. Mm-hmm. So obviously that is the coolest thing that's ever happened to anybody ever. And people start talking about Ida, how she miraculously survived the fall and how she gave up being the countess and like the magical stag. It's she's got a very cool vibe going on. And the nuns of the abbey invite her to live with them. They're like, hey, you don't have to like sleep on a bed of pine needles and like poop in the woods anymore. Like, you can come stay with us at the abbey. And Ida's like, okay, but only if I can have my very own private cell that I'm never allowed to leave and no one is allowed to visit me. And they're like, I don't really feel like enforcing that.
She's but... like, and if you could add some stalactites and some moss.
Literally just wants to live in the cave.
Just closer to town.
And she's like, if I ever try to escape, I want you to make sure that I cannot get out. And they're like, you know what? I don't think this is a good fit.
I feel like we should rescind our offer.
Right, but it's too late. So they have to like let the weird girl live with them. So that's what she gets. And she loves it there. It's all she's ever wanted her whole life, just to be fucking left alone.
Mood.
Yes, except she's not alone for very long because she starts becoming tempted by a demon. And this is something we've seen that happens to a lot of people that hermits especially seem to be susceptible to, because they're just like left alone with their thoughts 24/7. Like, you're definitely gonna dredge something up.
Oh no, what does that say about me? I'm always in my house.
Have you been tormented by a demon?
I don't think so.
I mean, you have like television though.
I do. That's that like keeps the devil away.
Exactly. That's actually like a very good distraction from demons, I would say.
They're trying to get my attention. I am way too engrossed in Broadchurch.
Just watching Angels and Demons, ironically, over and over again. Just
so, like, I can stare at the hot priest.
Staring at Ewan McGregor.
Mm-hmm.
He is super hot in everything. Just, like, one of the most attractive men I've ever seen. So the summary of the hagiography says that this demon appeared to Ida in the form of a poltergeist. When I think poltergeist, I think Peeves from Harry Potter. Like, they're just kind of dicks. Was the Bell Witch a poltergeist?
Yeah, you could put it in the same kind of vein. Everybody has a different idea of what a poltergeist is.
Like, yeah.
Depending what culture and even what witch you ask, you're not going to get the same answer. Some people think it's a spirit. Some people think it's a demon. Some people, I've run into this theory, don't think that it's, they think that it's somebody's psychic energy that they're repressing that is going out and causing damage. So a poltergeist isn't the same thing from person to person to person.
That's what I figured. So I
destructive was... is like the gist, though. Like wild, chaotic, destructive, whatever it is.
Mischievous.
Worse than a ghost.
Like a ghost, but worse, because they can actually, like, fuck with your shit.
Yeah.
And they'll
mess with a lot of stuff.
And they tend to be, like, attached more to people than places.
Yeah, in my experience, ghosts, in my experience, I've seen apparitions, I've had things like knocks out of windows and stuff, but what I've heard about poltergeists is, like, hearing voices and lights flickering and shit, like, moving across rooms and disappearing and all kinds of stuff like that, so.
Yeah.
Just a tad more sinister.
Yeah. I was trying to find, like, what people in Switzerland or Germany at this time would have thought, because it is like a German word, obviously. That means noisy spirit. So yeah, this is just like a troublesome spirit. But I thought it was interesting how the text said that it was a demon taking the form of a poltergeist, because that made me wonder about belief in ghosts.
You see that too with demons a lot, though, that a lot of people would be like, oh, I have a little girl in my house, a little girl spirit. And people are like, no, that's a demon disguising itself as a ghost to get you to let your guard down.
Yep.
If it's one step, like, less, like, malicious than it is, then.
True. Then you won't be, like, so afraid of it, which is actually a trick.
Yeah, because you might be like, oh, this is just, like, a noisy spirit, not something that can, like, actually feed on me and, like, corrupt me and do a bunch of really horrible things.
Right. I was interested specifically because this guy writing it who used that word is the dean of an abbey in the 15th century. And, like, I know we've talked about, like, this stuff before, like, a lot. And we talked about, like, the tests that medieval clergy would perform to try and see whether an apparition was, like, a demon or whether it was the ghost of a Christian soul in purgatory. So that would involve things like asking the spirit to recite a prayer. There was a widespread belief in the Middle Ages that things like ghosts could very well be souls in purgatory who were contacting the living in order to ask for prayers so that they could get to heaven, which is what I was talking about in the intro, was this whole kind of thing. But this one is apparently not doing that. This is just a full-on demon. And this demon is tormenting Ida. It's distracting her from her prayers. So she prays for help from one of the deceased counts of Toggenburg. I couldn't find a name for him. I don't know if this was, like, her dead father-in-law. One of her husband's ancestors, I believe. I don't know why she chose this guy in particular, but the summary says that it worked and that the spirit of the dead count showed up in her cell and he was holding a light that scared the demon away. But thinking about it, I'm like, okay, so there's an attempt to ascribe a magical quality to this entire ancestry. That was my thought.
That, you know, with any sort of, like, you can use your own ancestors to help you.
Right. Yeah,
this
but
is,
it's
I'm
not.
Sorry, this is so very witchy.
I know.
The whole, like, calling on a ghost to help you against a demon. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it feels very witchy.
And there's a lot of, like, animal imagery, too.
Yeah, and the deer with the candles reminds me a lot about some of the deities and stuff that we worship.
Yeah.
One in particular that comes to mind is Ellen of the Ways. She's associated with deer.
Oh, that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Deer are definitely like a big thing, like Artemis and
mm-hmm.
who is that one who got murdered by her dad, who turned into a deer? Greek stuff, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So the hagiography ends by saying that Ida died on November 2nd, which is the Feast of All Souls Day, and that she was interred in the altar of the monastery church. And it says that through prayer, she protects people from evil spirits, sicknesses of the body, infestations of the head, and our favorite, hysteria. His account does not list any specific miracles, but I will come back to that in a second. Here's the thing. This could be bad news or it could just be interesting. I think it's just interesting. Some of the details in the hagiography and later stuff like the fanfic don't exactly match the like fragmentary historical record that we do have. So by looking at the sources, like the fragments of records, we can see that there was a countess named Ida around this time, but she wasn't from Kirchberg. She was from Hamburg, and she was actually descended from the Habsburgs. So this is why Saint Ida is sometimes called the Habsburg Saint. And this historical Ida did become Countess of Toggenburg, but her husband was named Diethelm, not Heinrich. There was no Heinrich who was ever Count of Toggenburg. Also, she was married twice, not just once. But she did become a hermit, and she was interred in the Abbey Church. So where does like the plot of the story come from? Like the raven, the stag, like all the weird shit, like where does that even come from? Who made it up? Like what's going on? It turns out that there are a lot of similarities between the hagiographies of Saint Ida and legends of Saint Genevieve of Brabant. Saint Genevieve was accused of adultery and was sentenced to death by her husband, but her servants left her in the woods alone instead of killing her. And years later, her husband found her in the woods. The big difference between her story and Ida's story is that when her husband found her, he took her home and they lived happily ever after. I much prefer Ida's twist where she's like, fuck you. I'm not your fucking wife. And so now the issue of like miracles. The original 1470 hagiography, so before Albrecht's hagiography, that one did include a list of miracles, but Albrecht's Latin translation did not. And that was actually a common distinction of the time. Hagiographies written in vernacular language for use in very localized cults would often include a list of miracles, while the ones translated into like a higher register, like Latin, did not. The ones in Latin, especially the ones written at the time, like turn of the 15th century and onward into the Renaissance, they did a lot of work to classicize the story. So for example, they would include allusions to classical Greek texts, like Albrecht named the hunter who discovered Ida's cave Achates, which was the name of Aeneas's companion in the Aeneid. There are also references to Mount Olympus, Socrates, and even like some phraseology, like, you know, like phrases in the Iliad where it's like dawn's rose-colored fingers. Mm-hmm. It's stuff like that. So all these things were just like ways of shifting the tone to a higher level, to be taken like more seriously on a grander scale. So it's like, we want this woman to be recognized as a saint, not just in our little community, but also by the Vatican and by the entire world, because that is going to bring our community glory and cha-ching tourism money. if people decide to go on a pilgrimage here. And if this saint is a Habsburg, the Habsburgs sure will reward us for telling her story. So it's like all kinds of motivation. But of course, we can't forget our simple little peasant cult in the area who are like so happy to have a saint to celebrate. So let's say that her feast day will be celebrated on November 3rd, even though she died on November 2nd, because November 2nd is already All Souls Day. So she needs her own special day. It kind of reminded me of Parks and Rec, that lizard cult, where he's like, could we have the park on this day? That's the end of the world, according to my calculations. And Leslie's like, can't. We got an ice cream social that day. And he's like, oh, my mistake. It was the following day. And she's like, that's free. Great. She's like, okay, May 15th, end of world. Got it. And another thing they did was they re-included the list of the original list of miracles from the 1470 story so that they could tell pilgrims about them. I couldn't find the list. I wish I had, but based on the summary, it was probably like healing of both physical and mental illness. That's what I would assume. Almost done. So here's the deal with Ida's canonization, because this is the point where I'm like, she was canonized by Pope whatever and whatever year. But in order to talk about that, I have to talk about Catholicism in Switzerland and how it works, because it's unique in a way that I hadn't heard of before. In the vast majority of Catholicism, you have a strict hierarchy of intermediaries that leads back to the Pope. Obviously, we know that. Your parish priest is subject to the bishop of the diocese, who is subject to the archbishop of the archdiocese, or the metropolitan see. So for us, that would be Chicago. And this archbishop may or may not also be a cardinal, but either way, they're subject to the Pope. But in Switzerland, there are six dioceses or bishoprics, same thing, and no archbishoprics or metropolitan sees. This is known as an exemption. So these six dioceses are directly subject to the Pope in a way that is uncommon. To make things even more complicated, Switzerland is divided into 26 cantons, I think 26. Like you mentioned, these are previously independent states or prince bishoprics, and many of these cantons have their own Landeskirche, or land church, meaning regional church that has authority in the region. Landeskirchen have their origins in pre-Reformation Holy Roman Empire times, like we've been talking about in this episode. Nowadays, these are both Catholic and Protestant churches, and the Landeskirchen have always had like extra independence in terms of their internal structure and their relationship to their king, and in Catholic cases, their Pope. So there's conflict on all sides in all situations. Like, where do taxes go? Should Swiss Catholic churches be called Landeskirchen? Because that implies that they have some degree of independence from the Pope. Should we institute an archbishopric? Where would that go? Like, it's a lot. And I think it's fascinating because it goes back to like it has to be a direct correlation of this area having such like a rich history of belonging to different countries and being inhabited by so many diverse groups of people. All of that is to say that Saint Ida is only a saint in the exempt diocese of Constance. She's a very localized saint. She is officially beatified by the larger Roman Church, which was done in the 18th century, but she was never fully canonized. She is the patroness of headaches. Should have prayed to her earlier. Pregnancy complaints. And of course, the patroness of finding escaped cattle.
Of course.
I love that, because
how could you read her story and not think that's what she was responsible escaped for?
Cattle. It's not in the story at all, which is so great, because to me that says that's just what people in that area are concerned with all the time.
Who's the first one to do that? They're just like, hey, could you help me find my escaped cattle and work? They're like, she's really good at helping me find cows.
Really good. They're like, oh, a miracle, I found my lost cows. Saint Ida must be super concerned with my lost cows. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is Saint ? Or Blessed Ida of Toggenburg.
That's interesting. The kind of saint who got yeeted down into a ravine and said, I must stay.
Mm-hmm. I like it here.
I'll just put up a sofa over in the corner and maybe some farmhouse decor.
Live, laugh, love sign.
One of those Himalayan salt lamps.
Mm-hmm. She was vibing down there in the ravine. She loved it.
With her weird pet stag.
Mm-hmm. The stag that had to fulfill its duty every single morning at the ass crack of dawn. Just like,
I like to imagine the Count getting remarried, though, and explaining his ex-wife who lives in a ravine below the castle in a cave.
Don't worry about it. She's totally chill. She won't come up here ever.
You might see her around town. Just don't make eye contact.
How'd she get down there? We don't need to talk about it right now.
The floors were wet. She slipped. There was no sign.
No sign. No wet floor sign. No cuidado sign. Oh my gosh. The priest is like, do you know of any impediments to your marriage? I just went through this because I'm getting married soon. And we had to meet with the priest, and our parents had to come and like sign a document that says that we've never been married before. That was fun. He's like, do you have any impediments to your marriage? Have you been married before? Are you currently married? Henry's like, that's a toughie. That's the thinker.
That's difficult for sure.
His wife's just staring like, what?
She's like, this is a very basic question.
Yeah, not for him. Switzerland.
You are interesting, that is for certain. We'll definitely be back here in the future, even if we have to look at just figure out where the country lines were drawn back then and go from there.
My mind, that area is just like jello, just like a pool of jello.
This has been fun.
Yeah. There was cheese. There was mention of chocolate. There was a magical deer.
There was murder.
There was a lot of murder, a surprising amount of murder.
There was romance.
Romance. There was a dead baby. There was
Castaway.
There was Castaway starring Tom Hanks.
We really just pack it all into an episode.
Yeah. And we will continue to do that week after week, fortnight after fortnight, until we die.
Until we die.
Yeah. We will see you next time. And thanks be to God.
Blessed be.